I have trawled the depths of Goodreads to find one-star reviews of some of my favourite classic books so that we can read through them together. My name is Joe Folley, and this is Unsolicited Advice. Right, next up we have a pretty damning review of Wuthering Heights by Emily Bronte, and I'll just read a section from it. Ultimately, the most damning thing is that the characters are a bunch of immature, insufferable, narcissistic assholes with very little self-respect. This isn't a story of great love and passion, it's the story of how child abuse perpetuates itself through the generations. The characters are either emotionally abused as children, or, as in the case of Kathy Wan, they're spoiled and overindulged with no discipline and can't muster the restraint and self-respect to ditch abusive relationships. I keep waiting for any of the characters to be remotely worth my time, but I found no respite from the brutish abuse of the horribly twisted Heathcliff or from the simpering idiocy of Kathy 1 and 2. Ugh! Not only are there no transformations or growth, but the characters aren't even that likable to begin with. How this book got to be a classic is beyond me. So, I think this person has picked up on something that is quite distinctive about Wuthering Heights, which is that basically there aren't many likable characters. Even the ones that lean towards being more likable, like, I don't know, Edgar is like reasonably likable at points. He's still got this kind of haughty elitism about him. Isabella Linton, I think, is quite a likable character from Wuthering Heights. And I quite like Nelly, although I think she has her moments of being not very nice as well. I'm currently working on a video about Wuthering Heights. I'm seeing the film in a couple of days, so I might put my like film hot takes at the end as a kind of separate section. But I largely just want to write a video on the book. And I, for that video, I've been rereading it. So I actually, you know, have Wuthering Heights pretty fresh in my mind. And I do think this person is right to say that the story isn't of a great love or passion. Well, maybe it's of a great love or passion, but it's not of a good love or passion, right? I think that I'll probably say this in more detail in the video. The thing that I find interesting about Wuthering Heights is Bronte, Emily Bronte, that is, because obviously there are three of them, has a depiction of love that is both incredibly powerful and incredibly amoral. So one of the narratives that we often tell ourselves about love is that love makes you a better person. And one of the really distinctive things about Wuthering Heights is that love makes nobody in the novel a better person. In some ways, it exacerbates people's worst attributes. And even people who are kind to the one that they do love, someone like Hindley, for example, are still like absolutely abominable to the people that they don't love in quite the same way. So I think that one of the reasons why I quite like Wuthering Heights is sort of precisely for the reason that this person has disliked it so much. It's that it's a very anti-romantic book in a lot of ways, as in anti-romantic in our kind of colloquial usage of the term. I think it is a book of very powerful passions, but I think it's a book of deeply amoral passions. And I think that's something that I really appreciate about it. I think that, you know, the fact that Heathcliff and Kathy, or Catherine, I suppose, depending on Kathy 1, you know, the older Catherine, one of the reasons why I think their love story, and I will defend calling it a love story. I think it's a deeply unhealthy love story, but I still think it's a love story. I think that one of the things that I think is so brilliant about Wuthering Heights is that it is both a love story and a horrible tale. And yeah, but one of the really distinctive things about their love stories is basically this kind of immature, horrid mutual obsession where they don't even make one another happy, really. And half the time they make one another miserable, and they spend a lot of the novel, first half of the novel, just griping at one another before, spoiler alert, Kathy dies, the elder Kathy dies. And so, yeah, they don't make one another happy at all. They have a deeply unhealthy kind of love and obsession with one another. I don't think that's a bad thing about the book. We have loads and loads of love stories where people are ennoble one another with the power of love, and they become better people and they improve one another. I don't think it's the worst thing in the world to have a story with a much less rose-tinted look at what great and terrible passion can do. You know, I think that the passions of Heathcliff, especially both his, you know, loving passions, his kind of positive passions in the sense that he's desiring something, and his negative passions, things like his envy and his resentment and his spite, things where he's like trying to reject something, push it out of his world. Both of those, I think, show the intense motivating force of those kind of deeply held instincts. At the same time, yeah, they end in disaster. You know, it's just, there's no two ways around it. I think that's like not necessarily a bad thing, though. You know, why? I don't think that we should pretend that strong emotions, even when they're labeled such wonderful things as love, always end well. I think there are, you know, we many of us will have been in love, and it would have been a horrible experience. I think that we can do well to detach a sense of ultimate happiness from the concept of love. I think, you know, love is a strong amoral emotion. It can be both brilliant and awful, especially in its more wild, erotic form. And I think that Emily Bronte communicates that point really, really well. And I that's why I really like Wuthering Heights, at least. I think that yes, the characters can be narcissistic and horrible. And, you know, one of the other reviews, the one-star reviews of this book said, "I've tried it 3 times. I know people are obsessed with it. I hate everyone in the book, and I just can't care about a book where I actually hate the characters. And sure, I get the interpretation that as terrible as Heathcliff and Kathy are, it's their love that redeems them, and isn't that romantic?" No. And I think it's partly because people have the habit of desiring a kind of redemption for these miserable characters. And I think that, you know, Wuthering Heights has the kind of skeletal framing of what looks like it could be a redemption at the end, because again, spoiler alert, once Kathy and Heathcliff are both dead, their kind of ghosts are seen wandering on the moorlands together. I don't think that that's a redemption. I think that it's a kind of purgatory. I don't think it's like a damnation either. I think it's just they are together. And are they happy or are they not? I'd wager that they're probably not happy. I think they're probably making one another miserable for eternity. Or if they are happy, it's going to be a very unpeaceful kind of happiness. It's not going to be the embrace of a still, calm heaven. It's going to be this kind of tumultuous, constant battle of the wills with this intense erotic undertone. I just think that the fact that they're not redeemed, and the fact that they're unlikable, isn't a vote against the book. I think it can be a vote in favor of it. If you want to help me make more videos like this, then please consider subscribing either to the channel, or if you're feeling incredibly generous and want to gain access to exclusive content, including my slow motion book by book bookshelf tour, then consider subscribing to the Patreon, though it's absolutely no pressure. The links are in the description. Okay, next we have a 1-star review of Osamu Dazai's No Longer Human. And it reads, "I'm going to be honest, I believe the main reason I hated this book so much was because of the expectations that were set for it. This book got a ton of hype, which was what made me look forward to reading it. Ended up disappointed and upset. The narrator, Yozo, is insufferable, and I couldn't look past that. Some phrases here and there were really nice, that I will admit. But otherwise, this book was quite a drag. A guy that thinks he's so different just because of his people-pleasing tendencies and severe social anxiety. Yozo's a freak, and I hated him. No Longer Human's filled with misogynistic crap, and it's such a bore to read. Took me 3 months to finally get through it. 270 pages of the word fart printed over and over again would have been a lot more entertaining in comparison." So clearly, they didn't enjoy it very much. Yeah, I think that it can be very difficult to wrestle with a book with a deeply unlikable protagonist sometimes. But I do think that, you know, I don't think Osamu Dazai is unaware of Yozo's unlikability, partly because Yozo himself points out his unlikability quite a lot. He doesn't, you know, he's not kind of walking around having incredible self-esteem and thinking that he's, you know, the shit. He is really quite down on himself for the entire book. And something that a lot of the one-star reviews for this sort of tend to miss out is that Yozo isn't miserable for no reason. At the beginning of the book, it's explicitly stated that he is abused by someone who works for his family. And that kind of colours his whole view on the world. Yozo's almost unaware of this, right? Because in his own narrative, he kind of skims over it. But nonetheless, like, the fact that it's in there is important, because this experience is part of, a pretty major part, in my opinion, of the events that shatter his relationship with the world. It's part of why he feels no longer human. I think that whenever I see people that really don't like No Longer Human, because I really didn't think that I would like No Longer Human when I read it. I only read it because it kept getting recommended to me, and I thought, right, okay, there's probably something in this. But yeah, I whenever I've met people when I've then gone and recommended it, and they've said, oh, well, you know, the protagonist's kind of annoying and he's kind of self-hating. I've tried to pull out the fact that he was like abused as a child, and this is part of the explanation for it. And that tends to give them a slightly more charitable view on things. I mean, Yozo's still like a deeply self-destructive and an unlikable character in a whole host of ways. I don't necessarily think that is a vote against the book. I don't get the sense that Darzai was trying to write a really likable protagonist and failed. I get the sense that he was attempting to explore a deeply self-destructive and self-hating and sorrowful character and succeeded in doing that. And I have a real soft spot for books that have deeply unlikable protagonists. Obviously, Notes from Underground is like the prime example of this, follows such a horrific and nasty protagonist. I quite like that in the sense that it doesn't happen all that often. It's like an oddity, especially it being done well, I think is a real oddity. And it's nice to have a kind of psychological portrait of this kind of character, considering that we have so many likable protagonists, right? By far the majority of protagonists in books and even in classic books are eminently likable. It is nice sometimes for a bit of variety to explore like a deeply horrible and unlikable character, even when in this case, the unlikability is given some kind of explanation that we would tend to consider sympathetic, right? You know, if somebody was really awful, you know, just rude and nasty, and then somebody told you that they were like abused as a child, I'd like to think that will probably make me have a bit more sympathy for them. And I think a lot of people would probably have that same kind of reaction. I do, however, agree that No Longer Human is quite heavy going to get through, if that makes sense. So this person read it over the course of 3 months, and it took me a surprising amount of time to read. It's not a very long book, and it's not a very like difficult book to read because of like the language or anything like that. It's very, very simply and excessively written, well, at least in translation. But it is relentless in its presentation and exploration of misery, and that can be unforgiving, especially if, you know, I've got a real tendency to absorb the moods of the books that I'm reading. So if ever I'm reading something like that, I like to have a very lighthearted kind of Jeeves and Wooster book on the side to cheer myself up. And yet it took me a while to read No Longer Human because of that. Even though, I mean, this person says it's 270 pages. I don't think that I read it on ebook. I don't even remember it being that long. I thought it was like, you know, maybe 200 or so. But anyway, I would say, I think that something positive to take away from this article is that in many ways they've identified what's so interesting about the book, and that just hasn't been to their tastes. And also, I think they've raised an important point about how if, like myself, you're the kind of person who absorbs emotions from books quite easily, you may want to have a bit of lighthearted reading on the side to cleanse your palate after you've read No Longer Human, so that you're not just, I don't know, in an awful mood for your friends and family. Right, here we have possibly the most famous one-star review of a classic book ever, because this goes viral on Twitter all the time. And it's a review of Pride and Prejudice, and it reads, "Just a bunch of people going to each other's houses." I think at some level, this review captures what a lot of people find frustrating, not just about Austen, but about like a whole heap of different classic authors and classic books. I don't know if it's just like coincidence or whatever, but there seem to be an outsized number of classic books that are largely based around the medium of conversation and people talking to one another and social interaction. I'm not saying there aren't like action-packed classics. I mean, the Iliad is like the classic of all classics, and that has like oodles of action in it. But it seems to be that a lot of classic books are about dialogue and talking. And thus, this frustration seems to come up an awful lot. I think that when it comes to Pride and Prejudice, I think two things are really helpful to bear in mind. The first is that the historical context of the novel at the time is very important, right? So Elizabeth Bennet's quest for a husband can seem really odd in its urgency from our modern day perspective looking back, because, you know, we kind of think, well, you know, you don't need a husband urgently, Elizabeth. Why are you, you know, tearing yourself up about this? But of course, the context in which this is taking place is that Lizzie doesn't just need this match because she's like a head over heels romantic or something like that. She also needs it out of economic necessity because it's the only way for her to ensure her and her family's future financial stability. So within context, although it's a lot of people going to houses and chatting to each other, the conversations really matter in a straightforward material sense to the people in the story. So that's one thing to bear in mind. I think that this kind of lack of context happens with quite a lot of other classic novels or plays as well. So this sometimes happens with things like why a particular crime is considered totally abhorrent. So I remember I was talking to a friend who's an English teacher, and he teaches Macbeth. And I sort of said, you know, why is it that the murder of Duncan is painted in Macbeth as like the sin of all sins? Why is it that that is given such outsized significance, given that the play is chock-a-block with death and killings and stuff? What is it about that that stands out for Shakespeare? And he's a very, very, very clever guy, much cleverer than I am. He sort of said, well, what you've got to understand, Joe, is that in the context of this time period, regicide, the killing of a regent or a king, is like the ultimate crime. So like the closest analogy to a modern day crime that would carry the same kind of moral weight would be, I actually can't say it out loud on YouTube, so I'm just going to say like Epstein-y stuff, and you can all catch my drift by what I mean by that, in that regicide in the context of Elizabethan England was a total upending of the moral order, or the perceived moral order, right? This is another reason, by the way, why sometimes the moral outrage at the killing of the king in France during the French Revolution can seem strange to a modern eye, just because we're not used to We just don't recognize, even in the UK, which is still, you know, a monarchy, albeit a constitutional monarchy, we don't recognize just how important the figure of the regent, the king, the Queen Regnans, was in Europe well into the kind of late 19th century. We're just not in their head, so we can't understand how abhorrent this would be. But it really is a kind of total toppling of the moral order. And to take this back to Pride and Prejudice, I think that an appreciation of the context helps clarify the stakes of what Elizabeth Bennet is going through. And I think that, again, it's not just like you or I going to people's houses. It's like if you were visiting people and every visit could rescue your family out of future financial ruin, or damn you to that financial ruin should you be caught in the wrong situation or have your reputation besmirched and suddenly you're no longer a marriageable prospect and everything's gone absolutely horribly wrong. So the stakes are higher. But also, I think that one thing that's really helpful when reading a book about conversations and social interaction, where that's the kind of meat and potatoes of the plot, is to think about the emotional actions happening in each scene, right? So from one perspective, when Darcy first proposes to Elizabeth and Elizabeth rejects him, that's just a conversation, right? It's quite a, you know, it's reasonably pedestrian conversation. We've all probably either been rejected or rejected someone in our time. So we've all been through this kind of conversation, albeit maybe not rejected for a marriage proposal, but rejected for asking somebody out on a date or something like that. However, the emotional stakes of the scene are so much higher than that. So it's about, I think, enjoying these kinds of books. It's something that I'm lucky to sort of find naturally compelling. But when I think about what I find so naturally compelling about them, it's that I'm not just looking at what happens from a kind of plot perspective. I'm enjoying the emotional plot as well as the physical plot. And I think that that can kind of help get someone in the mood to enjoy this sort of story, right? Especially if your usual enjoyment in reading comes from like action scenes or quick plot development. A lot of these books, you know, just a lot of classic books, tends to move a bit more slowly. Not all, but a fair amount of them. I don't think that's like controversial to say. And although they do tend to move quite slowly plot-wise, emotionally, there is often an awful lot of things happening. So I know I always talk about it, but like The Brothers Karamazov, right? Very, very slow moving plot, but each scene has an emotional arc to it. And if you if you find that sort of thing really compelling, it can be, even when it seems like no straightforward plot development is happening, because there's so much character work going on, it can still be really, really gripping. And I think that Pride and Prejudice and Jane Austen more generally is very similar. That doesn't mean there's anything wrong with, like, if you're not particularly used to enjoying that style of writing. I'm not saying that you're like, you have to. I'm just saying that it's something to, I think, generally be aware of when approaching these kinds of books, because it can just be a genuine difficulty. And if you are interested in enjoying these works more, and ultimately I think that the aim of reading classic books is to enjoy them. It's not to, you know, beat ourselves over the head with them and say, oh, we really ought to read this. It's to get as much joy out of them as we possibly can. I think that seeing scenes and chapters in terms of emotional arcs is really helpful. At least I find that very helpful when I reflect on what I tend to enjoy about these stories. Right, next we have a one-star review of Dostoevsky's The Idiot, and it reads, I gave up. I hated it. I love Crime and Punishment, but I hated this book. It reads as if it was written by a drunk. It's as if Dostoevsky was making it up as he went along. I think many who love this book only did so because they couldn't believe an author so great could write something so ridiculous. This, actually, I found isn't that uncommon of a reaction from people who really enjoyed Crime and Punishment going into reading The Idiot. It also has a really astute observation, because it reads, it's as if Dostoevsky was making it up as he went along. And as I've pointed out on the channel a number of times, I think, Dostoevsky kind of did make up The Idiot as he went along. It was much less thoroughly planned than the rest of his books. So yeah, it's actually very cool that this person has picked up on that without presumably necessarily knowing the background. I think that's really, really cool. I think that the difference between The Idiot and many of Dostoevsky's other books, things like Demons and Crime and Punishment, and even The Brothers Karamazov, although The Brothers Karamazov does have moments where the plot is less focused. I don't necessarily mean that as a criticism, because I think that leaves room for the character work. The Idiot, I think, is by far the least plot-focused of Dostoevsky's four kind of great novels, which are Crime and Punishment, The Idiot, Demons, and The Brothers Karamazov. So if what you liked about Crime and Punishment was the fact that it has a really tightly focused plot, it's very economical, not a word is really wasted, I can understand why you then wouldn't like The Idiot, which is much more of a kind of meandering character study. I really enjoy that, because the thing that I like about Dostoevsky is his character writing. So maybe a controversial take, I don't mind the pace at which things happen in a Dostoevsky novel. I would have loved if he wrote, you know, a 2,000-page novel where basically nothing happens and it's just conversations between characters, and there's that would really appeal to me, because the thing that I like about Dostoevsky is his character writing. I think that if you read Crime and Punishment, you really enjoyed it for the plot, The Idiot might be a very different reading experience, and it might turn out to not be to your tastes. However, you might be someone like myself for whom The Idiot is so to your taste that actually ends up eclipsing Crime and Punishment. You know, The Idiot is my second favorite Dostoevsky book, and it's a kind of narrow second to The Brothers Karamazov. Yeah, but I can really understand this person's frustration. I think I've mentioned this before, but actually I've got one of my favorite books on Dostoevsky is by a guy called John Jones, and he like absolutely hates The Idiot. He's got great commentaries on Crime and Punishment and Demons and The Brothers Karamazov, and he just like skipped over The Idiot. He just thought, no, I'm not talking about it because I hate it. And I kind of respect that. And I really do think that The Idiot isn't to everyone's tastes, and that's absolutely fine. I wanted to hone in on this review partly because of the line, it's as if Dostoevsky was making it up as he went along, because he kind of was. And I think that it's an example, I think, of the kind of wisdom that you can sometimes find, or the astuteness you can sometimes find in reading very negative reviews of your favorite books, because sometimes they pick up on something and you're like, yeah, that is true. That's so true. In fact, I'm always surprised by the number of very, very negative reviews for books that I really love that actually identify all of the things that I love about it. You know, these aren't inattentive readers. These are people that have picked up on all the things that I find so compelling. And they just don't find them compelling. I think that's my favorite kind of one-star reviews. This is definitely falling into the camp of excellent one-star reviews of excellent books. Okay, next up we have a discontented review of Plato's apology, which, for context, Plato's apology is actually Socrates' apology. It's his defense in front of the Athenian court, because he's been charged with various different crimes, like I think it's blasphemy and corrupting the youth. And he's giving his defense of his sort of philosophical approach in front of the Athenian assembly, and the Athenian assembly are going to decide whether or not to first convict Socrates and then to sentence him to death. And they eventually do sentence him to death. And that's, I'm going to say spoiler alert, but you know, I think most people know that Socrates ends up dying. And Socrates, in his defense, he's not contrite at all. He basically just gives a full-throated defense of his own work and says that, no, if you let me go, I'm going to keep doing it. And this review takes a lot of umbrage with that. And it reads, "All I know is that I know nothing. However, you, dear Athenians, know way more nothings than me. Therefore, I know and you don't. Now I'm going to come bang at your doors one by one to tell you all to your faces, then be all surprised that you don't like my telling you so. Finally, to remediate you getting all vindictive about the insult, I'll respectfully demonstrate to you at my trial why I think you're all morons." I don't know what the social cues were at the time of Socrates, but for a self-proclaimed wise man to have put himself in a position to get ambushed like that defeats the purpose of wisdom, in my opinion. Either he knew beforehand the lot of them aren't wise and won't listen to reason, in which case saying anything at his trial would have been redundant, or he was trying to have a reasonable argument with a bunch of fools, which kind of makes him a fool by association. The interesting thing about this review, first of all, I actually quite like the opening bit, because of course Socrates is told by the Oracle of Delphi that he is the wisest person in Greece because he knows that he knows nothing. Or that's his like interpretation of it. Because a lot of the apology or the defense is him saying, look, I thought I'm so ignorant of all of these things. And then I went and spoke to people who said that they knew things about virtue and about life and about these big questions. And I found out that they didn't know anything either. And so, you know, it's kind of justifying his continued questioning, his continued inculcation of felt ignorance in the hearts and minds of the Athenian populace. So, yeah, to a certain extent, he does say, look, I think the reason why that the oracle proclaimed me the wisest man in Greece is because I know that I know nothing, whereas everyone else thinks that they know things that they don't. I quite like the apology. I think that this is a fun speech. The other thing that I wanted to talk about is that this second half of the review, I think, really touches upon a difference in the way that we understand wisdom today and the way that Socrates would have understood it. So when it says that Socrates can't have been that wise because he allowed himself to be put in this position and then doesn't even have the prudence to defend himself, like properly, like give a contrite defense that would have allowed him to be spared and maybe even let go so that he can then continue to do some form of his work. That's not how Socrates would have seen wisdom. A lot of our understanding of reasonableness and rationality and wisdom today is like very prudential. It's to do with like, okay, you desire something, and desires are unaccountable. There's no accounting for taste. But that then your command of reason or your rationality or your wisdom or what have you is all about how well you can judge the means to that particular goal. That's not how Socrates would have seen things. Socrates, at least from what we know from Plato, would have instead thought that part of wisdom, and an essential part at that, would be knowing what ends to desire. And he actually says this in the Phaedo when he is given the option to escape. You know, he's about to drink the hemlock. His followers, a couple of them, say, look, Socrates, we reckon we can smuggle you out of the cell. You know, you could be free if you want. And Socrates refuses this and says, no. It is right for me to obey the command of the court and to drink the hemlock. And you might think that that's ridiculous, right? Because he's acting against his own self-interest in such a flagrant way. Socrates would say, A, that a philosopher ought not to fear death because he believes in the immortality of the soul. But also that desiring good and virtuous ends for their own sake is part of wisdom. And that might involve going against self-interest at times, even to the extent of giving up your life, you know, that which is plausibly dearest to you for the sake of desiring and subsequently achieving the good end. So Yeah, I think that the reason why I quite like this is because I think Socrates would probably accept the critique that he is not being prudential. And in fact, he is critiqued for not being prudential by some of his followers, and he rebukes them for this. And I think that it's because Socrates perceives wisdom to be partly desiring the correct ends. And that is a conception of wisdom that I think, you know, crops up an awful lot, especially sort of in pre-Enlightenment philosophy. You know, it crops up in, I think, Boethius, it crops up in Plato, crops up in Aristotle. There is a significant tradition of viewing wisdom and viewing reason in a far wider sense than our current more instrumental way of using these terms. I don't know. I think it brings out kind of a historical difficulty. The fact that what Socrates would have seen as the wisest course of action is by this person writing in the modern day. And I don't think they're unusual in this point. This is something that a lot of people say when they read the Apologia. They say, well, come on, man. Like, if you're so clever, why didn't you just talk your way out of this and then you could have got back to your philosophy? And I think actually that's such an interesting and profound observation to make, because it draws out the distinction between reason and wisdom according to Socrates and reason and wisdom according to us. And I think that's really interesting, which is why, despite the fact this person didn't enjoy the Apologia, I think they clearly got something quite useful out of it. Right, here we have a review of The Lord of the Rings by J.R.R. Tolkien, and it reads, "Save time, watch the movies. This book can appeal only to a linguist. The underlying story is great, but it is buried under an avalanche of horribly annoying songs and poems that do nothing to advance the story. They just take up space. I diligently read every last one, hoping that they held some deep meaning in relation to the story. But if there is one, it is so obscure that it serves no purpose. Also, the book is all about walking. Yes, I know they're on an epic quest and there has to be soul-searching, etc., but the amount of detail regarding the walking is a snoozer. 45 pages of walking and 3 pages for a huge battle. Ugh! I know that this is a masterpiece, and I agree that the plotline is a beautiful tale of good and evil and power and corruption. However, reading this series was a drudgery. The only really good part that you miss in the movies is when the hobbits return to the Shire in the last 3 chapters of Return of the King. If you want a Tolkien fix, I'd recommend The Hobbit." So there are a couple of things about this review that I really appreciate. The first is that, yeah, there isn't a pretty absurd amount of walking in Lord of the Rings. That's something I quite like, because again, I kind of quite like the slow pace of it. And also, I think Tolkien's just got some absolutely gorgeous descriptions of natural landscapes. I actually talked about that a little bit in my last video. So I think that I sometimes see those walking sequences as just opportunities to bask in Tolkien's description. But yes, there is an awful lot of walking. I don't see that as a bad thing, but I can totally see how someone would see that as a bad thing. There's a kind of parody song about this. I'll link it in the description, where somebody's kind of done a sketch about Tolkien pitching this epic quest, and then he goes into more detail about the plot, and he's like, well, they walk, and then they walk, and then they walk, and then something's following them, but then they do a bit more walking, and it's very good. As I say, I'll link it in the description. I really haven't done it any justice at all there. The other thing I wanted to pick up on here are the poems and the songs, because The Lord of the Rings is partly based, inspired by, I know Tolkien like hated the idea that people saw The Lord of the Rings as an allegory for World War One, but it's undeniably inspired by parts of his experiences there. And I think I don't know if this holds in like modern soldiering, but songs and kind of marching tunes especially used to be like a really big part of both kind of soldiering and walking. Like, I don't know if, how many people are in the audience are sort of really big on hiking. I'm quite fond of hiking. The UK has so many like wonderful places to hike, so we really are spoiled there. And hiking is also really wrapped up in song. People used to sing songs as they hike. In fact, people still sing songs as they hike or they walk long distances. Because, you know, especially in the age before being able to put some headphones on and listen to some music or whatever, that was kind of how you kept your spirits up and entertained yourself with the other people that you were walking with. And likewise for soldiery, marching tunes and songs were quite a big part of soldiering culture, from what I know, at least. I may be wrong, I may just be totally misinformed, but like I'm pretty sure that's correct. And moreover, specifically pertaining to the First World War, of course, poetry was a huge part of the legacy of the First World War. And I think that's part of the reason why poems and songs take up such space. They don't take up that much space, but the fact that Tolkien puts them in, I think that's a big reason behind it. The other thing that I think this person picks up on is that, yeah, the poems aren't obviously thematically relevant at every point they're introduced. But I think that it's important to note that one of the things that really shapes Tolkien's attitude as a writer, I actually didn't have time to talk about this in the last video, otherwise I would have done, is he's trying to instill in the reader something that he calls secondary belief, which is sort of where it's quite a kind of tricky concept. And I think it makes more sense just kind of phenomenologically. You know, when you're like really absorbed in a story or a novel, and you sort of start to believe things about the world inside the novel with a weird kind of significance that you would normally reserve only for the natural world. Actually, you know, Tolkien's such a good example of this because, you know, think about online, how people get really heated about like bits of the Tolkien mythos and you know, they'll have arguments over bits of the Silmarillion. They'll say, oh, no, you got this wrong and this is what's... Like, we get invested in fictional worlds to quite a large extent, and Tolkien refers to this as secondary belief. And I think that part of the poems and marching songs and stuff like that, and just the things that Tolkien leaves totally unexplained in his book, I actually think a really good example of this is The Watcher in the Water. You know, when Frodo and co, the Fellowship, are going through the mines of Moria, and they're just outside, and this kind of sea creature starts kind of fighting them. That's called The Watcher in the Water. And Tolkien in the books just like never really goes into much detail about what this is. You get a few hints. It's like a kind of, I can't remember the exact descriptions, but it's referred to as like a kind of dark and old type of creature. And the thing that I love about this is because it's not expanded upon, it kind of intimates this world beyond what's being described, that's kind of alive and full of complexity and wonder that we specifically don't get access to because we are largely being told an incomplete version of this world from the perspective of the Fellowship and, you know, the people the Fellowship bump into. So I think that part of the reason for having all the songs and the poems in there is because, like having the Watcher in the Water, who doesn't get much detailed description about him, but nonetheless adds a kind of depth and verisimilitude to the world, so too the existence of these songs and poems, which might seem irrelevant or unfamiliar or tricky to us, but the fact that to the characters in the story they are totally natural tells us something about that world. It tells us that they have hiking and walking songs just like we do, and they're grounded in their world, which may be mysterious to us, but nonetheless is there. It signals to a world beyond. And, you know, it would break the illusion if Tolkien just included like a walking song that's from our world that people might be more familiar with, because these creatures are not from our world. So no, I think that the description in The Lord of the Rings can seem very extravagant and overly verbose or something like that. And I think that once we understand that one of the main considerations that Tolkien has when he's crafting it is this aiming towards secondary belief, this wish to create a world that is just as felt as real as our own, then I think we can kind of understand why there is this wealth of description and why there are things that he refers to seemingly just to kind of give a bit of flavor. And I think part of it is because that builds the world. You know, Tolkien is known as a great writer. He's also like a great world builder. I think I can understand this person's frustration, because if that's just not something you enjoy, it's just not something you enjoy. But I don't think that, I think that Tolkien would simply defend his decision to include this kind of depth of description, and where it's not description, it's intimation, because I think that it serves his aims. I also feel like I can't be too hard on this review, because I've only read through like the whole of The Lord of the Rings from start to finish, from like page one to page K once. I haven't like gone back and reread it loads of times. What I have done is I've gone back and reread my favorite bits, which I know I feel like that's not particularly unusual. But what it does mean is that if this person's complaint is that there are loads of parts he didn't like, well, there are loads of parts that I haven't gone back to reread. And to a certain extent, I suppose I'm voting with my feet there, or maybe voting with my eyes. I'd be interested to note, actually, for people who are fans of the Lord of the Rings books, have you gone back and read the entire thing from start to finish more than once? Or are you more prone to like reading particular chapters or like even reading particular books? I have read like the first 50 pages of Fellowship so many times just because I like the cozy feel of the Shire. And if anything, that bit before the plot gets started is so lovely. I just love like languishing in it. So in many ways, I've read the prologue to Lord of the Rings probably more than I've read any other part of Lord of the Rings, which I think is very interesting. But anyway, I'd be interested to know whether you also take this piecemeal approach to rereading Lord of the Rings, because I think it actually lends itself very well to it, because the story is very familiar and you can basically flip to any random chapter in the Lord of the Rings and know where you are in the story without too much effort. But that's personally how I now mainly read Lord of the Rings. So I don't know, maybe I'm just being very sacrilegious here and I really should just go right to the start and go right to the end again. But I don't know, let me know. Right, that's all we have time for. If you want to see more of these casual style, lighthearted videos, I've got a playlist of them right here. Thank you so much for watching and have a wonderful day.